From WIPR, I'm Sheila Cast. We're on the record. Despite public perception of the risk of terror attacks, in reality, they're surprisingly rare. So says Gary LaFrie, director of the National Consortium for the Study of Terrorism and Responses to Terrorism at the University of Maryland. He joins us to discuss his new book, Countering Terrorism, No Simple Solutions, which looks at the challenges of understanding and responding to this global threat. One particular obstacle, LaFrie notes,
of the 2,600 terrorist organizations in our database, half of them have only one attack. So there's essentially nothing you can say about them from a statistical standpoint.
We explore the value of collecting data about terror attacks and perpetrators, as well as social media as a recruiting tool, and President Trump's suspended travel bans. It's On the Record after the news.
You're listening to On the Record, the podcast, a service of your public radio, 88.1 WYPR. Find more podcasts online at wypr.org. And tell us what you think. Send an email to ontherecord@wypr.org.
Good morning, I'm Sheila Cast. We're On the Record. In his speech to Congress last month, President Trump laid out his rationale for barring individuals from parts of the Muslim world from entering the United States.
We have seen the attacks at home, from Boston to San Bernardino to the Pentagon, and yes, even the World Trade Center. We have seen the attacks in France, in Belgium, in Germany, and all over the world. It is not compassionate, but reckless to allow uncontrolled entry from places where proper vetting cannot occur.
The president's original ban and a more recent version were both halted by federal judges. Not only was the ban criticized as religious discrimination, terrorism experts pointed out that none of the people behind fatal terror attacks in the U.S. since 2001 were from any of the countries listed in the executive order. Today, we'll try to understand terrorism, its perpetrators, and the United States' attempts to address this threat. My guest is Gary LaFrie. He's a professor of criminology and criminal justice at the University of Maryland, College Park, and director of the National Consortium for the Study of Terrorism and Responses to Terrorism there. He's also co-author with Martha Crenshaw of Stanford University of Countering Terrorism, No Simple Solutions, published by Brookings Institution Press. Gary LaFrie, welcome to On the Record.
Good to be here.
Twice the president's bans on travelers from predominantly Muslim countries have been blocked. What do you make of the bans as a tactic to reduce terrorism?
Well, I think, as you said in your introduction, from the best data we can collect on the topic, it looks like had these bans been in effect since 9/11, it would not have saved any American lives. We can't find a single case where the citizenship statuses of the countries involved were involved in fatal attacks on the U.S. homeland. We do have several attacks that involved injuries from countries involved in the ban. But if you look at the most recent cases, the most common countries represented for those cases that were by non-U.S. citizens were Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates, and Egypt.
So would you expect these bans to have any impact?
This is an interesting question. In some ways, this gets to the heart of our book because There were three incidents involving non-fatal attacks. One, you might remember, was a case where a guy was shot dead after stabbing nine people in a Minnesota mall. None of those nine people were killed. So what if one of them had been killed? So now we have a situation where there was a life saved. But you have to sort of put that in perspective. I mean, are we banning people from countries that send us bad drivers and kill people on the roads? Are we banning people that come to our country and commit other types of crimes and so on? In other words, you have to sort of put these things in perspective. And certainly it's the case that if you want to really be effective, I would think you'd want to target the countries where we really have had a serious number of attacks, which again, our lead case there are Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates, and Egypt.
Polls show that Americans' fears about terrorist attacks have never returned to where the level it was before 9/11. Perception of the danger of terror attacks tends to flare following an incident. How worried should we be?
This is a great question. We've been tracking, we do national surveys to track public opinion about terrorism, and you're absolutely right. the levels of concern are still quite high among Americans. And we've spent a lot of time thinking about why that's the case. And I have to think part of the reason is that we now live in a world where we're constantly bombarded through both the regular media and the social media with events from all over the world. So, for example, I was planning a trip to Europe a while back, and my 92-year-old mother said, well, you can't go to Europe. It's too dangerous. There was this attack in Brussels, an attack in Paris. So, in other words, we now hear about attacks anywhere in the world, and we see that as perhaps directly in our own backyard, even though, of course, most of the places you're going to travel are, you have an incredibly rare chance of being attacked.
How rare?
It's an incredibly rare event. For most countries of the world, there are no attacks. In the United States, in recent years, we've had very, very few attacks. Sometimes we've had some years in recent years where we've not had a single fatality on the U.S. homeland. They're very concentrated in a few countries, and the countries in which they're concentrated change over time. So, for example, in the 1970s, most of the terrorist attacks in the world were in Western Europe and, to some extent, North America. In fact, the United States had more terrorist attacks in the 1970s than any time since then. Then in the 1980s, terrorism moved much more to Latin America. So we had lots of attacks from groups like the FARC and the Sendero Luminoso and the FMLN. Then there's a kind of a pause before 9/11, and then we have this latest period where attacks are concentrated, especially in the Middle East, Southeast Asia, and to some extent, Sub-Saharan Africa. So they're very rare. And events that take a lot of lives, mass casualty attacks, are rarer still. We've tracked about 160,000 terrorist attacks in our database going all the way back to 1970, and about 15 of those attacks have killed 300 or more people, so about 15, which, of course, is horrendous. But then you think about that on U.S. highways last year, I think something like 38,000 people lost their lives in traffic accidents. We have worldwide something like 500,000 homicides a year. So, you know, extremely rare compared to other kinds of fatal events.
When you talk about terrorist attacks, you're talking about terrorist attacks in which lives are lost as well as others?
Correct. In our database of about 160,000 attacks, more than half of all attacks result in no casualties at all. And you think, how can this happen? It's terrorism, after all. Well, in some cases, particularly in earlier periods, groups like the IRA and the ETA used to try to avoid casualties. And unfortunately, that's much less common these days. In other cases, terrorist organizations are not trying to cause casualties. This is true, for example, of the environmental and animal rights groups like ELF and ALF. And finally, in a lot of cases, terrorists plan to kill someone, but they just fail. They're just not successful at it.
And those, presumably, would be the kind of attack which would get very little press attention.
Exactly.
And very few people would hear about it to begin with, and very few people would remember it.
Well, not exactly. And this goes back to your earlier question about why is the public so concerned about terrorism. If you remember, for example, if you think about, for example, the underwear bomber, it was called, it happened on Christmas a few years ago. No one was killed, and yet I think it caused a great deal of angst and concern. Similarly, we think of the shoe bomber, which caused a great deal of concern.
Changes for us at the airport.
Yep, huge changes. So even when no one is killed, the story can pick up a fair amount of interest among the public.
Well, you have written about black swan events, a black swan being an unusual creature. That's how black swans were seen in Europe before it was known that they actually do occur in nature. What do you mean by a black swan event when you're talking about a terrorist attack?
Well, a black swan event is a kind of game changer that is very difficult to predict in advance. And with regard to terrorism studies, the biggest example of a black swan is the 9/11 attacks. We now have tracked, as I say, over 160,000 terrorist attacks around the world going back to 1970, almost a half century. And to this point in time, the 9/11 attacks are still the deadliest attack in the world for almost a 50-year period. And when you think about the impact that 9/11 has had, you think about, you know, a war in Iraq, war in Afghanistan, a direct connection perhaps to the Arab Spring from that, massive immigration, the biggest migration patterns we've seen in since World War II, huge change on politics. I think we could argue that 9/11, not just on the United States, but in the entire world, has been a real game changer, has really changed human history.
That's Gary LaFree here on The Record on WIPR. He's a professor of criminology and criminal justice at the University of Maryland College Park and director of the National Consortium for the Study of Terrorism and Responses to Terrorism. We're talking about the book he co-authored, Countering Terrorism, No Simple Solutions. The unit you direct, the National Consortium for the Study of Terrorism and Responses to Terrorism, collects data about terror attacks around the globe. Why is this valuable?
If you go back to the day after 9/11, no one in the United States, no one in the world could tell you how much terrorism there was, whether it was going up or going down. They couldn't tell you how much violent extremism there was in the United States, whether it was increasing, decreasing, which ideologies were represented, and so on. So when the START Center began in 2004, our first goal was to start to build a sort of science of terrorism, to use the same sort of tools that we use in criminology and in psychology and in other fields to understand things like suicide and homicide. And we assume that if you're going to counter terrorism, the first step is to understand how much of it there is. And you can imagine, for example, trying to solve the problem of cancer without knowing how much there is, or solving unemployment without knowing how much there is. So we set out 15 years ago first to come up with the most reliable, objective data we could get on just how much terrorism was occurring around the world.
What does this data tell you about the characteristics of the perpetrators of terrorism? Are there common denominators?
Absolutely. And now, of course, remember what this database is doing is tracking events. So we collect the data if there has been a terrorist attack. So we only find out about the perpetrator if we know something about who did it. But it does give, I think, some very useful policy sorts of information. One of the real surprises, I think, to me personally, when we started to get into the data, because nobody before us had collected both domestic and international data, one of the things that continues to surprise me is that even if you look at groups that specifically go out of their way to target the United States that are based in other countries, they still spend most of their time attacking local domestic targets. In other words, a group that, say, in Pakistan, for the most part, is attacking Pakistani targets in Pakistan, which I think before we had these data, I would have been surprised to learn that. Another thing I find fascinating about, since we've been able to collect data both on domestic and international attacks, is that one might think with that the world is shrinking, that communication and transportation systems continue to become more sophisticated, but we're not finding international attacks are increasing over time. In fact, the opposite, that over time, over the history of our database, the ratio of domestic to international terrorist attacks has actually gone up. So as a proportion, there's actually more domestic attacks than ever before.
We hear often about a lone wolf involved in a terror attack. Is the lone wolf associated with the black swan? Is that an unusual situation in a terror attack, or is a lone wolf an important concept in how terror attacks come to happen?
I think it's a very interesting concept, and increasingly, given the impact of the internet and social media, you sort of have to wonder whether there can be such a thing as a lone wolf anymore, because most of the time, individuals who operate on their own are very much influenced, oftentimes over the internet, by groups or by social movements. Even before the internet, for example, Timothy McVeigh wasn't really that active in any particular group, but he was clearly being influenced by a much broader set of organizations and was very much influenced by things like the Turner Diaries and so on. So he operated basically as a lone wolf, but yet he clearly wasn't operating entirely alone, even though he really didn't receive much material support. In fact, no material support from an organized group.
So we should really think of people who perpetrate terrorist acts as part of a group.
I think it's hard to imagine someone engaged in terrorism who doesn't have at least some connection to an ideology outside of themselves and therefore to other groups.
We also hear a lot about self-radicalization. Somebody who was not preached to at a mosque, for example, to be radical, but taught him or herself that way. Is that common?
I think it's becoming more common. And I think if you're going to look for game changers in the area of terrorism, I think the social media clearly is one of those game changers, that it's now possible to be online and get connected, sometimes directly, even person to person, with whatever ideology you're particularly interested in a way that wasn't possible even 15 or 20 years ago. So I think this notion of self-radicalization has become much more important. It's sometimes, I think, overemphasized. When we've done work, for example, looking at how individuals use the internet, individuals involved in extremist violence, they often are also engaged off the internet. They're going on and off. They're not just solely on the internet for the most part. But nonetheless, the internet allows you to get connected with radical ideologies anywhere in the world very rapidly.
And can the government break that link, stop that process of self-radicalization?
I think it's actually challenging. In part, imagine, for example, how police operate, basically. So you have a suspect, so then you're going to try to follow that suspect and then perhaps follow the close connections with that suspect. But think what happens when that suspect is online and suddenly that suspect is connected not to just one or two other people, but to dozens, perhaps hundreds of other people. So very rapidly, it's very difficult. It's impossible, really, for law enforcement to pull all the threads, to follow all the leads that are introduced when you get onto a media as complicated as the internet.
We're going to take a quick break here. This is On the Record on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast. When we come back, the challenge of crafting a counterterrorism policy. Stay with us.
This is the On the Record podcast, a service of Your Public Radio, member-supported 88.1 WYPR. You can support this podcast and everything you hear from WYPR. Become a member. Come to WYPR.org and click the donate link.
Welcome back to On the Record. I'm Sheila Cast. I'm speaking with Gary LaFree of the University of Maryland. He's a professor of criminology and criminal justice and director of START, the National Consortium for the Study of Terrorism and Responses to Terrorism at the University of Maryland. He co-authored the book Countering Terrorism, No Simple Solutions, published by Brookings Institution Press. In the aftermath of the September 11th attacks, the U.S. took quite a few actions. Established Department of Homeland Security, went to war in Iraq and Afghanistan, captured enemies, held them at Guantanamo Bay, began a program of drone strikes. Is it possible to untangle any of these actions and determine what impact they had, if any, on terrorist attacks?
I think it, in theory, is possible. I mean, we think we can study other kinds of complicated behavior, so why not study counterterrorism? I will say, though, that while I think researchers have made lots of progress in terms of understanding terrorism since 9/11, we're much farther behind when it comes to studying counterterrorism. I think I could predict that we are going to get better at it. But if you think it's difficult to collect information on terrorism, it's even more difficult to collect it on counterterrorism, given that governments often want to be very secretive about information regarding counterterrorism. But we're starting to see research coming out on a whole variety of different sorts of responses to terrorism. Sometimes, they can be very muscular military responses or conciliatory actions. So I think we're going to see in the future more and more work telling us sort of what works in terms of our goals and in terms of what we're trying to accomplish under a variety of circumstances.
But you don't think we have that yet?
I definitely do not.
President Trump uses the phrase radical Islamic terrorism, while his national security advisor, Lieutenant General H.R. McMaster, has discouraged use of that phrase. Is this an issue of style or substance?
I think there is a substantive issue underneath, and I think it's very difficult to sort of hew a middle ground between those two views, but very important in the area of terrorism because with regard to responding to terrorism, it's always possible to make things worse. That we have a phenomenon where, on the one hand, a kind of muscular response can deter future bad behavior. On the other hand, it can lead to backlash. So I sort of find this is a real minefield. There are a number of researchers, quite a few researchers, that argue that religion is irrelevant. And I don't agree with that because it makes people willing to do things to sort of violate norms that they wouldn't otherwise violate in the name of their religion. At the same time, though, I think it's often not a situation where you have a kind of clash of religious civilizations, that it's somewhere in between. And I think one of the things we were just talking about in terms of designing an effective counterterrorism policy is to get that right, is to come out so that you're not making things worse, that you're not really setting up a situation where you're going to get so much backlash. And if you think about it, those things really depend on the specific details of the attacks. If you look at, for example, 9/11, that event probably would have been very difficult to have prevented with just ordinary police work on its own. On the other hand, if you look at this Omar Mateen case in Orlando recently, a military response to those sorts of attacks is also not likely to be very effective. So in other words, the nature of the specific attack and the threat we're facing, I think, really are going to tell you a lot about how you come down in terms of specific remedies.
Remind us of the Mateen case.
Mateen is the case in Orlando, the nightclub shooter,
which was
an incredibly devastating attack in terms of human life. It was the most serious attack we've had since 9/11 in the United States in terms of fatalities.
This is On the Record on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cass speaking with University of Maryland criminology professor Gary LaFree, co-author of Countering Terrorism, No Simple Solutions. That's the subtitle of your book, No Simple Solutions. What makes it difficult to craft counterterrorism policies?
Well, I think a number of things. One, the fact that terrorism is so rare. Even groups that are incredibly important, like Al-Qaeda, we have maybe 65 attacks from Al-Qaeda. So you think about how do you generalize based on such a small sample. In fact, of the 2,600 terrorist organizations in our database, half of them have only one attack. So there's essentially nothing you can say about them from a statistical standpoint. On top of that, and I think the public's often surprised by this, in about 50% of the thousands of cases we looked at, we don't know who did it. We've never figured out who did it. In some cases, even with very high-profile attacks, we never figured out who exactly was responsible. So that makes it very difficult. You think about how are you going to craft policy when you don't even know who's responsible for it. Then another very difficult issue that you alluded to earlier is we think of terrorist organizations as a kind of stereotypical. I think we may think of an Al-Qaeda or the 9/11 attacks. But what we actually encounter is far more diverse. We have some fairly well-organized groups, and Al-Qaeda being a prominent example. But then a lot of the attacks that have happened in the United States in recent years have come from individuals like Omar Mateen in Orlando or the San Bernardino attackers, with no real connections to an organized terrorist organization, operating pretty much on their own, perhaps with some connections on the internet. Or you look at the Boston Marathon case also, where these individuals did not have strong connections to a group. So we think about terrorism coming from groups, but a lot of it's coming from individuals with relatively weak connections to groups. And even from the work that's coming from groups, it's often from groups that are evolving very rapidly in an almost kaleidoscopic fashion, that have a lot less substance, that are a lot less corporeal than I think we're used to thinking about. In some ways, more like the way many gangs operate. They come together but are not organized, do not have a long history, do not last over time, do not have stable leadership.
Does that imply that their ideology and goals are shifting too?
It can, of course. I mean, I think that certainly happens over time, that groups come and go, and that as we try to study this phenomenon, we oftentimes are in a situation where we sort of have to take the word for individuals that they're connected to a group. But what that actually means is often extremely variable.
What else keeps us from putting together a cohesive counterterrorism strategy?
Well, I think in addition to these things, we know very little about what works when it comes to our responses to terrorism. There are beginning to be more work in this area, but I think a lot more work on, for example, in what situations do military reactions work the best, in what situations do striking at the leadership of an organization work the best? Are there situations where conciliatory actions work the best? Can you have some combination of those sorts of actions? And once you come up with those with some information along those lines, how generalizable is it? Does it work in different sorts of situations and so on? So I think we're making progress there, but have a long way to go.
I really appreciate your taking time to walk us through this. Thank you.
Thank you, Sheila.
University of Maryland professor Gary LaFrie is co-author of the book Countering Terrorism, No Simple Solutions. He directs the National Consortium for the Study of Terrorism and Responses to Terrorism at the university. This is On the Record. I'm Sheila Cass. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow.